Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Professor Susan Rotland makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of her most recent book, Lone Voice, The Wars of Izzy Liebler. Some of you will know Izzy, some of you won't perhaps, but Susan will tell us all about him. Now, I'm going to introduce her in a minute now, briefly, as Professor Emerita at the Department of Hebrew, Biblical and Jewish Studies at the University of Sydney. She's published widely. I guess her two best-known publications are The Jews in Australia, a two-volume work, and more recently, in 2015, Let My People Go, The Untold Story of Australia and the Soviet Jews from 1959 to 1989, which she co-authored with Sam Lipsky, and which was the winner, or the joint winner, of the 2015 Prime Minister's Literary Awards for History. But today, the topic is Izzy Liebler, Lone Voice, and Izzy's Wars. Susan, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard, for the introduction and for inviting me tonight to speak about the late Izzy Liebler, who died on the 13th of April. And he was a personality larger than life. As we saw in newspapers, and it's over 20 years since he lived in Australia, moved to Israel officially in 1999, but as we can see here in Australia, both in The Age and an article written by Tom Cowie, Izzy Liebler, key advocate for Jewish refuseniks, and also in The Australian, where Alan Howe entitled his obituary, Extraordinary Izzy Liebler Changed His World. And Howe quoted from Labor MP from Melbourne Port, Michael Danby, who said, and I'm going to quote a bit of this because I think it's a good summation of Izzy and his contributions, that he was incorruptible. He has no peer in Jewish diaspora leadership. Howe noted that, as was often the case, the feisty and hardline Liebler and Danby had their moments. Actually, it was more than having their moments. I remember meeting Michael at the time of the first Gulf War when I was doing research in Melbourne, and he was scathing of Izzy. But Izzy, many of the people initially where there were tensions, they made up. And Michael actually worked for Izzy for a short period in Jet Set before he went into his political career. And so he said, in earlier years, Izzy Liebler and I had many ups and downs, but over the last decade, we developed a firm friendship based on mutual respect and an immovable devotion to the Jewish people and Israel. Many senior politicians I introduced him to reveled in his fruity evaluations, and that was Izzy. He was certainly fruity. His profile in the broader Australian community was for decades that of the authoritative voice of the Australian Jewish community. And the World Jewish Congress, where again he played such a key role on the international school, in their article referred to him as passionate and committed to the future of world Jewry. And noted that Izzy helped with the sustainability of both Australian and Soviet Jewry throughout his life. Other tributes were published right across the Anglo-Jewish world, in the United Kingdom, and in the United States. So how is it that Izzy came to have so much coverage? Well, over the last 20 years, I had the honour and privilege of researching in Izzy Liebler's unique archive and extensive library, what I call a treasure trove for a historian. You might ask how I got the key to this treasure trove. At the end of last century, I was approached to write a history of Jewish communal leadership in Australia, a task I still have to complete. And I became very engrossed in the struggle for Soviet Jews. And while I was working in that research, I realised that Rex Mortimer, a communist leader, had played a key role and had actually admitted to Soviet anti-Semitism in Izzy Liebler's 1965 landmark publication on Soviet Jewry and human rights. When, in 1998, I was working through Mortimer's security file, I found a number every time Izzy Liebler's name was mentioned, and that told me he had a security file as well. And after 9 months back and forth with the National Archives, when they stated they couldn't find the file, and I kept telling them it was there, they had to locate it, they finally did. As part of his efforts for Soviet Jewry, Izzy was constantly tracing Australian communist leaders because he'd been urged by the legendary Shaul Avigdor, one of the founders of the Mossad in the pre-state era and a key part of initial Israeli intelligence, who recruited Izzy in 1959 to see if he could get communist leaders to admit that there was anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union. There was no point other people saying that, because the communists would just say, oh, they're anti-communists. But if a communist leader who'd spent time in the Soviet Union, as was the case in Rex Mortimer's case, and did say that there was anti-Semitism, and this is the example of one of the books published in the early 1960s. It was called Judaism Without Embellishment. As you can see from these images, it was highly anti-Semitic. And it was this type of publication which led to Mortimer writing this letter, which is, I'm not going to try and read it out to you, you can also look at the book, acknowledging Soviet anti-Semitism in the booklet which Izzy published in 1965. So during a visit in December 1999, I came armed with copies of some of the telephone transcripts that I had located from Izzy's file. Izzy's phone was not being tapped, but the phones of the communist leaders was. And this was a conversation between Judah Watton and Bernie Taft. Now, Judah Watton hated Izzy with a passion. And by the way, Izzy hated him as well. And so he was not very complimentary of Izzy. And I showed Izzy some of this conversation, and he was chuffed. He'd always suspected he had an Asiophile, but now I had the proof. And that was the key which opened the treasure box for me to be able to research in his archive, his private archive. I also had access afterwards to his private library of 40,000 books, but could have accessed it elsewhere. The archive is unique to around 200 bound volumes, each of 1,000 pages, each colour-coded according to topics. So Soviet Jewry, 40 volumes, Asia Pacific, which is green, Soviet Jewry, of course, is red, about 15 volumes, and his I.J. Liebler personal Altogether, I did 80 volumes, each of 1,000 pages, which was blue. So with this huge amount of material, one of the challenges in writing a biography is how to structure the biography. Should I make it entirely chronological, or should I do it thematically? I looked at Jill Margot's biography of Frank Lowy, which won prizes, and Jill had done her biography, which I'd read, pretty much chronologically. But I felt for Izzy's biography, I wanted it to combine themes with chronology, and so if you look at the book, that is what I did. In this short talk, and half an hour is not very long to cover a very long book, there are so many facets to Izzy's life that I can only touch on a few. I have been asked, why did I call it Lone Voice? And it really was a suggestion of my editor, Elliot Lieger. But I knew that I wanted the title to have something about Izzy as a fighter, because Izzy had fought battles all his life, sometimes totally upsetting people. He could be very pugnacious in his approach and very tough. At the same time, he often was a lone voice. And this started when he was a schoolboy responding to anti-Semitism in his government school, when his Jewish friends were pushed into a shed and he wanted to retaliate. They said, no, don't do anything. And he found out who were the non-Jewish boys involved, and through with non-Jewish friends found out each of those boys and beat them up. So that was Izzy. He was a fighter. And that was true to his battles with Qantas, what I might say, battles that enabled him afterwards to build an amazing company. So here, this was a cartoon with him standing on the crocodile. It really sums up who Izzy was. Moving on then to another, the major campaign, which Sam and I wrote about, but in the book here it just focuses on Izzy, where, and I've already told you about his role with the communists, and then he, through to his efforts, Australia's the first country to raise the issue of Soviet Jewry in 1962 in the United Nations, but again, that came at a cost, with a huge fight between Sydney and Melbourne due to the position of Sam Cohen in what he said in the Senate, and Sam was a strong left winger. And then, of course, was his battle with Dr. Nachum Goldman, head of the, at the time in 1966, of the World Jewish Congress. And Goldman wanted a quiet, you know, quiet diplomacy. Izzy believed in demonstrations. In the end, Izzy was proved to be correct. Well, it was this aggressive leadership which also marked his role in combating anti-Semitism, which is an ongoing story. In the 60s, it was with the right, with the League of Australian League of Rights on the one hand, with Eric Butler, and the anti-Bolshevik block on the other, was East European Jews, some of whom came from a virulently anti-Semitic background. And Izzy, as well as fighting, also believed in using academia. Maybe that's why he ended up asking me to write a more academic work of his biography. And he took two key academics, John Playford from Adelaide, actually sadly didn't publish from his work, but I've certainly used all his work on Nazi war criminals in Australia, and also Ken Gott from Melbourne, who did publish on the extreme right, the Australian League of Rights types, in a publication called Voices of Hate. He also had a huge battle with Qantas. In 1965, he went into a business with Bonawena, a survivor of the Łódź ghetto in Europe, and it was out in the shticks, as we say, a one-man office. But then he clashed with the leadership of Qantas. You have to read the book. It's incredible battle. Qantas really literally tried to destroy him and got the issue to IATA, the International Association of Travel Agents. He, for a year, he was not able to trade properly. But in the end, he did win that battle, and that was Izzy. One of the fascinating things about Izzy's life, of course, is the close friendships he had with key leaders both here and in Israel. And, of course, the close friendship he had with Bob Hawke in the days when the Hawke was head of the ACTU. And I have done a lot of research on this. I've published on it. I'm a little bit limited in what I can say tonight because of time constraints. So, again, it's a matter of reading the book. But I just have to read you a little bit from what the Australian ambassador in Moscow wrote in 1979 when Hawke went on a trip to try and advocate for the refuseniks and those who'd been imprisoned, those who want to leave the Soviet Union for Israel and had were being really punished by the Soviet government. And Hawke went at Izzy's bidding. At that stage, Izzy was not allowed into the Soviet Union. That's another story. But I'll just read this little bit of the report because I was given special permission through Freedom of Information when I was doing this research to access the closed material in the Australian archives. And this report was actually hidden by the diplomats in the Foreign Office, or by the members of the civil servants, because it was before elections. Hawke had just said that he was leaving the ACTU to stand for Parliament. And the civil servants who were in Foreign Office were frightened that this report would be used, didn't want Peacock to see it because it was very negative to Bob Hawke because of his drinking. And Bouchier describes how the Soviet apartniks tried to accompany Hawke into his room with bottles of vodka. And they come into his room in the hotel after a meeting in the evening, and there's beer in the fridge as well. Open it up, and Hawke says, "I don't remember inviting you bastards to my room for a drink, so why don't you piss off?" "You think we'd better piss off, do you, Bob?" they responded rather lamely, but they knew the gambit had failed. "Yes," said Hawke. And Hawke then explains to the embassy official who's with him and to Bouchier that he wants to ring and contact the refuseniks. But unfortunately, the drink, as you'll read, had a very bad impact. Hawke was told that the refuseniks would be released if it was over 5 years, or at least that's what he thought he was told. He left Moscow having made that announcement. And then when he got to Rome, he discovered that that was not true. And in his memoirs, he writes, it's the one time he felt like committing suicide. But Izzy always, always also believed in bipartisan approach. And if he was extremely close to Bob Hawke, he also became extremely close to Malcolm Fraser. And here we have the two of them sitting together. When Fraser would visit his mother, who lived in Melbourne, he would often come to visit Izzy on a Friday night. And, you know, Izzy was strictly religious, so you can't turn lights on and off. So he would do it for Izzy, and they would sit till 2 a.m. drinking and talking. And whiskey's always part of the story. And sadly, Izzy was to get kidney disease, and the last years of his life needed to be on dialysis. So the other key area in terms of his activities was with the Asia-Pacific region. And again, Izzy starts with academics. It's really interesting. He had wanted to do a PhD, but Unfortunately, his father died when he was in Israel, having got first-class honours at Melbourne University, and, you know, top of everything. He was a brilliant man. And he had to come back. He had to go to Belgium, actually. His mother said, don't come home from the funeral. You have to go straight to Antwerp and learn the diamond business, which he did. And he was in the diamond business. He got married, children. His design, he enrolled for a doctorate, but he just never managed it. So then he drew on academics and in his Asia Pacific work, very much so, and by trying to hold symposia between Asian scholars and Jewish scholars to show the commonalities. And through this work, and again, I write about it in the book, his work with China. There we have, by the way, that's from 1987 in Hong Kong with Sir Zalman Cowan. His first visit actually was China in 1981. Izzy's work with Jet Set was not... the money was a stepping stone for his political activities. And then again, he went in 1985. He was campaigning for an academic symposia in Beijing, which eventually does happen in 1992. There's 1991, where he meets the Chinese foreign minister, who says, don't worry, it's going to be announced. And in 1992, China announces that they will recognize Israel. And then he also campaigns with India. I can't go into details here, but he also, India at the same time, recognises Israel. The other area, after acting as really an unofficial diplomat for Israel, he became very close to Israeli politicians. And I'll clip through this in particular, and really with the Israeli, from Menachem Begin, Shamir less so, Rabin, he was very close to. And the Oslo process, which of course is very controversial in terms of its failure. But Izzy initially supported Rabin, but later, as time progressed, he changed. And one of the key architects of Oslo was an Israeli politician by the name of Yossi Beilon. And Izzy brought Beilon to Melbourne. They became very close. Izzy actually supported the election of the Labour Party in 1998 against Bibi Netanyahu. But the second intifada, and people forget what a terrible impact that had in Israel, with suicide bombings going off, one never knew where or when, on buses. I was in restaurants. I was in Israel twice, a place that I walked past. In 2003, every day, walking to the National Archives of Israel, a cafe was bombed just a few days after I left. A bus that I was taking to visit friends bombed a few days after I left. One just never knew. And close to 1,000 civilians between 2000 and 2003 were killed in that period. Izzy turned from being a supporter, perhaps with questions about Oslo, to being an opponent and a supporter of Bibi Netanyahu. His journey mirrored that of most of the Israeli public today. Just to try and bring this quickly to a conclusion then, I know I have to watch the time. I would like to finish on Sunday. We had a book launch at the Sydney Jewish Museum. Luckily, it was in person with over 100 people. And Robert Goot, who was another key Australian Jewish leader who'd really worked with Izzy on the Soviet jury from, and I'll try and click through here, from the early 1970s onwards. He read a post, because Izzy's last years in Israel was as a columnist, writing for the Jerusalem Post, Israel Hayom. He had his own website, Candidly Speaking. And in August 2020, he wrote, civilization is currently facing the greatest threats since the rise of Nazism. Coronavirus and its social and economic byproducts have resulted in global waves of populism, accompanied by violent demonstrations initiated by elements of the extreme left and the extreme right. These elements, in particular the Black Lives Matter movement in America, are exploiting racial issues to host radical anti-Semitic groups and oppose Israel in their platform. After decrying the dominant liberal media and expressing astonishment that the vast majority of Jews regard it as incumbent on them to be seen supporting the BLM movement despite its anti-Semitic components, Izzy observed, many young people today are no longer able to visualize the powerlessness of Jews before the state was created. Robert commented that after reading the segment from Candidly Speaking, Word from Jerusalem, he commented that it's good that Izzy was not alive to see today what has happened in the streets of London, particularly North London, with people going through with Palestinian car convey, with Palestinian flags, really crying out obscenities, terrible obscenities, or Jews being bashed up on the New York streets. What perhaps strengthened Izzy, and I've referred to this, is his role, not only as a philanthropist, but as Rabbi Hirsch, who's the honorary life president of the World Union for Progressive Students, wrote to Izzy while he was still alive when the book was published in Israel. It took longer to be published here. I believe, more than anyone else in your generation, you have used your pen and your intellect as a voice to advocate for institutional integrity. And that really sums up Izzy right to the end of his life, and I read you 2020. He was using his pen as well as his philanthropic and success in business through the 1960s, as I told you, with his book on the case for Israel, on Soviet Union and human rights, to 1970s, the case for Israel, to 1980s for his strong opposition to the current day for against religious fundamentalism, whether it was mainly he wrote about Jewish religious fundamentalism, to his role as a columnist as discussed in the Israeli and general press. Now, where did he get that from? His love of books. When he was in Jerusalem as a youngster, after he finished his honours, he would write to his parents that every time he passed a bookshop, he would begin salivating. But then he had to check with the budget with his parents. And I can tell you, till his last day, I was in Jerusalem, till his last month, he was still ordering books for his extensive library. And only he knew where every book was. He had it all catalogued, but his PA didn't know where the books actually were. Actually, I got to know where a lot of those books were. So, and at the same time, he was a family man. That was the centre of his life, with his four children, his 17 grandchildren, and more and more great-grandchildren. So I would like to thank Izzy for giving me this opportunity to be able to take this journey into his amazing life story that I've just shared some snippets with you tonight. And I think he can feel a huge sense of achievement, and I think he did. We had a big virtual launch in Israel with Bar-Ilan University. That was on the 16th of March. He was in tremendous form, and apparently he went downhill after that and died on the 13th of April. And I'd like to thank Naomi, his life partner, my editor particularly, Elliot Yeager, his PA, Judith Lander, my children who supported me through this process, and I'd like to thank Gerard and Anne Henderson very much for supporting this event and for the many articles which I read in Gerard's unique archival collection that he wrote over the many years of the Sydney Institute. So thank you.
And so we come to questions and discussion. Just come up here. Just tell us, I first met Izzy in 1965, and my last communication with Izzy was when he asked me, told me about your book. So we had a long contact. But just tell people, he was born, Belgium? He then comes to Australia. Year and when?
Let me share briefly his family story, because one thing that's quite amazing about his family story and my family story is that they're basically the same, right? Both our parents came from Eastern Europe to Antwerp. Both our fathers were in the diamond business. In Izzy's case, his father was travelling in 1938, and he got sick in Singapore and ended up in Melbourne. And his mother had the vision to say, don't come back to Antwerp, I will come to Melbourne and join you with Izzy, who was a young almost four at the time. They arrived in June 1939. Similarly, it was my mother who had the vision, and I was lucky. My mother had two brothers here. One was very well-known, later well-known Jewish leader, Max Freilich, and they could sponsor my parents. And my parents, my older brother, also born in Antwerp, a little bit later than Izzy in 1936, arrived here in January 1939. And let me tell you, both groups were lucky, because the Australian quota for 1939 was 5,000, and 50,000 applications went out from Australia House to the continent in 1938. It was a 1 in 10 chance. How did it continue? What's amazing is that Izzy's father that I mentioned died in 1957. Izzy had to put his plans aside and go into the diamond business because his father re-established that in Melbourne. My father died in 1956. He'd also gone into the jewellery business here in Sydney. My older brother also had to, only for a year in the end it was, put his plans aside. He was studying medicine, and help Mum to sell the business and establish herself before he went back to the his medical studies. And not only that, but my older sister, the middle sister, was born in 1944 in March, and Mark Liebler, who himself had a biography, was born in, I think it's October 1943. And Alan Liebler, Izzy's younger brother, we were both born in 1946. It's an amazing parallel.
Thank you for that. Now, before we go to questions, and we're about to go, let me know if you want to. He's probably one of the most, someone who wasn't in politics, he's probably one of the most influential Australians of all time, to the extent that he had an international influence beyond Australia. So what drove him to that? I mean, he was a person very much involved in Australia, not only in Jewish affairs, but in Australian politics, but he's also focused internationally, a bit before his time.
Absolutely, and focused, by the way, on Asia before his time. I think, as I mentioned, the thing that brought him into international politics started as a very young man when he met Shaul Avigdor. Because Avigdor basically said, look, we've got Emmanuel Litvinov, who was head of, it was an office for East European Jewry, but secretly campaigning against the situation in the Soviet Union in London. And there was a man called Moshe Dechter in New York. Now, Izzy's a young man. This is the 60s, beginning of the 60s. I read all their correspondence. Amazing. So already when he takes on Nahum Goldman in 1966, he's got an international profile. So I think it was Soviet Jewry that pushed him into that. I guess from the Holocaust experience, which shaped him, I guess also shapes me in our passions, Holocaust background of our families, also gave him an international background. His parents travelled, and his interest in politics from a very early age. I mean, his first class honours were in politics. So all of that came together.
I'm a bit intrigued by the row with Qantas. Was that when he was with Jet Set?
What
was his trouble with? Could you explain? Because you didn't have time in your talk.
No.
Could you tell us about what he built up and how he came to have the row with Qantas?
Okay. It was, as you probably saw on the transparency, the firm which Bonawena established was called Astronaut. And he came in there in 1965 just to help Bonner out, because Bonner was in a mess. And Bonner attracted him in with the offer of cheap flights to Antwerp, which actually never eventuated. So that was the start. Now, Izzy was involved with sending the first group to Israel in 1965 of school leavers before they started university. And he realised that the benefit of group travel, before, this was where his vision came in, and maybe international vision. And so based on the success, it was called Academy, of this program, he started group travel for British, for Greeks, and for Italians. Now, when you have group travel, you want to use the cheapest flights. So you see where I'm getting at. Qantas didn't always offer the cheapest deal, and Izzy went for the cheapest deal. Not only that, but anyone who knows Izzy Liebler knows that he can have a very sharp tongue. And he greatly upset the Qantas leadership. Indeed, at one point, his mother, who was really very dominant influence in his life, told him, look, sometimes you can influence people more by being, you know, polite and kind to them, so to speak, than by fighting them. As I've mentioned, as he was a fighter. Qantas set out to destroy him, literally. And there were two cases, I don't want to go into detail because they're complicated, where Izzy was accused of breaking the rules of the International Association of IATA. One related to a Greek travel company. Some of the Greek travel companies were very angry at Izzy because, you know, with his group travel, again, he was doing deals with specific companies, the other ones left out. And they got a Greek man who was a gambler and in financial trouble to go into a scam, which, by the way, was all of the value of something like $10. But to try and prove that Izzy was doing stuff under the table, right? And that was the one accusation. The other, so complicated, was called Problem with Pago Pago. Now, Pago Pago is in Samoa, and half of it was part of the United States. So if you had a flight to Samoa, you could then get a domestic flight from Samoa to the US, and it was cheaper, but that wasn't allowed according to IATA. And there were just three German skiers who had learned that there was a way around that if you book with different airlines, and they did that. Izzy wasn't even involved in the booking, but that was the second accusation. And Izzy was Astronaut, not Jet Set. At that stage, they were just starting Jet Set, and it didn't yet have IATA registration. So it could continue travelling, but he was not allowed to get the percentage that a travel agent would normally get for any international flights. And it was 9 months. I don't know how he and Bonner, they were told, give it up, you're never going to win, so on and so forth. They kept fighting and won in the end.
I think it's fair to say this is in the days before Alan Joyce. It was when Qantas is a government-owned airline.
Right.
Lindsay.
Exactly.
He had a habit over the many decades of falling out with friends, family. Was that related to his personality, to his standing up for his philosophy? And many times he reconciled, especially with his brother, but what was that him?
I think it was both. He had three major, major fallings out. Let's deal with Joachim Schneebas and then his brother, because in some ways the falling out was over the same issue. That was a falling out of territory between the Executive Council of Australian Jewry and the Australian Zionist Federation. And in the first instance with Joachim Schneebas, it was an issue when Schneebas became president of the CAJ, wanting to take over, particularly where was tensions over what was the Asia Pacific Jewish Association, which as he had found, had established, and was part of his Asia work. And when Joachim Schneebas took over, he said, look, this is under the aegis of the ECAJ, and therefore I should now be the chairman. And it became bitter and even more bitter in 1982 over the handling of the Lebanon War. And so it was a mixture of power politics and how to approach situations. And that same issue became with Mark when it was an issue who should represent the Australian Jewish community, the Zionist Federation, which Mark was then heading, and or the Executive Council. And it's interesting, in the first conflict, which took place in 1982, as he supported his brother Mark, it was then with the State Zionist Council, which was the real falling out and over the handling of the Lebanon War. And the second conflict, Mark was then president of the Zionist Federation, and it was the same types of issues. So territory and power were key, but there was an element of ideology there that, as he said, when it came to represent, like with Mark, when it came to representing the Jewish community, it should be the ECAJ that did that, not the Zionist Federation. Now, in the end, Izzy made up with both Joachim Schneebas and with Mark. And actually, the brothers became very, very close. And, you know, the limitation in the biography, the only limitation for me, and I noted that Michael Gawenda, in his biography of Mark, did the same, not to include stuff on private correspondence. The third fallout was bitter and never resolved, and that was with Arnold Block. It was, again, tactics over handling of a radio 3CR, which was publishing a very pro-Palestinian program, very anti-Israel. And that falling out, actually, Michael Gawenda describes it in more detail, because in that case, it was Mark Liebler in the State Zionist Council, but Mark being supported by Izzy. And it was one of Izzy's great regrets, and for that matter, Naomi as well, that they never made up, and that Arnold, when he got sick in hospital, did not want to visit from Izzy.
Now, for those not out of Melbourne, 3CR was a left-wing community radio station based in Collingwood, I think.
Thank you very much for a stimulating talk, and I look forward to reading the book. My question relates to the difficulties of doing this sort of research, which you've described, particularly in archive material. Now, I note that the Australian archives are under threat at the present time as a resource in the future, because they lack the sort of funding that's obviously needed. But you mentioned as well that you relied on getting wiretap information, or wiretap transcripts, I assume. As someone who in the past has issued a few wiretaps, I just wondered what the difficulties were of actually identifying and getting access to them in the first place.
Great, great question, and I'm an archival researcher. I also use oral history, and I really started with oral history in my first book in 1970. But in terms of archives, I also started my archival research then. So I have journeyed in Canberra from different locations. Archival research, I guess the main thing is access. And as I said, getting that access, and it's unique. Izzy has not given, did not give that access to anyone else. The archive, his unique archive will go to the National Library of Israel, but with a clause, only when I finish using it. So I really was lucky. That was just a treasure trove. And how do you explain such luck, right? With the National Archives, I call it my regular pilgrimages to Canberra. I am heartbroken with what's happening there. Apart from the ethio files, look, when I did my work on Soviet Jewry, I had an archivist, Carolyn, I've got to think of her surname right now, but I did note my gratitude to her. It was wonderful. I could write to her. I could get the files I needed. I would arrive at Canberra. Everything was done. I loved working. You know, it was in the old post office there. Then now they've moved to the old Parliament House. Well, I haven't been now for a couple of years. And obviously, with COVID, everything's been restricted, so I'm not quite sure. And I'm so upset. The whole setup, the access, the everything, compared to, it was Carolyn O'Connor, compared to the assistance I had from Carolyn, just gone. And I think it's tragic. ASIO, yes, white ups, things are blacked out. There's nothing you can do about it. But there's enough in them. I've done a lot of research in ASIO files. There's enough in the ASIO files to give you meat to chew on. So what are the challenges? Apart from that, you need, in Yiddish there's a word for it, but I don't know what the, it's called zitzfleiss. You need patience with archival work to sit and do the research. And it's hard. It's long hours. It's hard slog. So,
definitely.
Going to
move quickly. So, Zeb, and
then we go here.
Oh, thank you very much. Congratulations, in a way. It's unbelievable to listen to your methodology. It looks like fantastic. In a way, I had a contact with Izzy when also working on Soviet Jewry, but also people from Poland trying to come to Australia, and he was extremely helpful. But I've got a very specific question. You are mentioning in your book Richard Krieger. Could you say a few words about the relationship between these two men, and especially about Izzy's help for Quadrant?
Yes, that's a great question. Very interesting. And it's one of the topics I'd like to go back to at some point, because the role which that played in the 60s and 70s with Richard Henry Krieger, and, you know, he had a bookshop, and yeah. I've already mentioned Izzy's love for books, and of course, Polish Jewish background, Izzy's father was born in Poland, his mother was East European background, so it really brought them together, and they shared, and it's fascinating, I quote him in the book, that at one point, Izzy contrives himself as I've forgotten the exact words, of something like a troubled conservative. But he is very involved with I think it's called the Foundation for Freedom, yeah. And Quadrant.
He becomes Association for Cultural Freedom.
Yes, precisely. And he becomes the honorary treasurer. I mean, obviously he's buying up books and journals from Henry Krieger, as he was known. So it was a very close association, and very important. They were pro the Vietnam War, and later in correspondence with Santa Maria. It's interesting because Santa Maria is opposed to Izzy on the Nazi war criminal story in the 80s, and Izzy actually writes to Santa, as he was known, "We were wrong on the Vietnam War," which is very interesting. But at the time, that was one of the things that was central in the foundation of Quadrant and so on. Later, as he loses contact with that, I don't know about with Henry, probably till he died because of the book connection, but he gets then caught up with the business story, as I've told you, the look, that battle with Qantas, unbelievable. And then it's Israel and then it's Soviet Europe.
Just before we go to the next one, just, you're on Bob Santa Maria, but I think it's also true that in the mid-60s into the 70s, they worked very closely together
extremely,
with respect to the Soviet Union.
Extremely. And they both shared a strong position of anti-communism.
Yeah, yeah.
But when, in the 80s, Santa Maria criticised the move towards war crime trials for Nazi collaborators who were here in Australia, they had a falling out.
There's a question here.
Yes. Back in the time when Izzy was young in Melbourne, I was not Jewish, I wasn't involved in it, but I knew a number of people. But I remember that there was considerable tension between what were the Ashkenazi Jews who come to Australia after the Second World War and the Sephardic group who were then represented institutional Judaism, as it were, in Melbourne. I never knew quite where Izzy was in all that, or whether he was actually one of the peacemakers. I mean, curiously, he's shown in one of your slides with Zelman Cowan, who I think was one of them.
Yes. Look, he wasn't directly involved in that battle. At that stage, he was, in the 60s, very caught up, as I've mentioned, with Soviet Jewry and such. 70s, Israel. I do know that when discussing this in the more present-day situation before he died, he mentioned that he did mention those tensions and did mention also that he had a Sfardi or Mizrahi, one of his grandchildren, and married someone from the Mizrahi background. So, yes, there were those tensions. What he was more involved with was the tensions between Reform and Orthodoxy, particularly working with Walter Joner and the late Lou Waller, Professor Lou Waller from law, and particularly in relation to tensions in Tasmania.
Was he liberal or reform?
Sorry?
Was Izzy liberal or reform?
Liberal was Izzy's orthodox. He was Mizrahi.
Orthodox.
Yes, very orthodox. But there wasn't much, and honestly I went through thousands of pages, about the Sfardi-Mizrahi issue. And actually, there are more here in Sydney. The Mizrahi Synagogue in Melbourne was established later than the Sephardi Synagogue, than the Sephardi Synagogue.
So for those who are not familiar with Jewish terminology, so one of this group's from Europe and one of this group's from elsewhere, right?
The Sephardi Jews initially, and that's why I use both terms, from Spain, the exiles from Spain, but who ended up in the Middle East, because Turkey was the one country that welcomed them at the time, the Ottoman Empire. The Mizrahi Jews are those Jews who never left the Middle East, and they have different prayer traditions, different customs to the European Ashkenazi Jews.
How do we fix that up?
I learned the sufferings of a Jewish through a movie called The Voyage of the Band 40 years ago. And I knew that it was the ambassador to Europe, or maybe to Germany, of the ROC. ROC issued so many visas to Jewish, led them to move to Shanghai, to China, escape the persecution. But after that, I always learned the reports that Jewish people, to show their faithfulness to Chinese people, but I think they were wrong. They went back to Shanghai and they embraced Beijing. Totally forget the ROC. What was that? This is the question.
What a question. I think I need another session. Particularly since for my doctorate I did major research on the Jewish refugees who escaped to Shanghai. And I have a major publication from 1987 in the Leo Beck yearbook on that story of and on Australia's policy after the war, when Australia limited the number of Jews, because Chiang Kai-shek ordered all stateless Jews to leave Shanghai immediately in 1945 after the war. Okay, I will not say many actually went back, not to live certainly. Izzy did play a key role in the opening up of China, but the reason why he did it is because he wanted China to recognise Israel. He saw that as being very important, and it was also very associated with the United Nations UNGA resolution of 1975, resolution 3379, that Zionism equals racism. And it really was on that basis, and I've spoken and again published more, and it's in the book, his efforts to bring not just China, India, Thailand, Japan, South Korea, all of the Asian countries to be more on side to Israel, because up till then that hadn't been the case. Now today Israel's in a real bind, but it's not just Israel with what's happening, as you know. The Western world is in a bind. How to deal what's happening to the Uyghurs is heartbreaking. And as someone who's concerned about human rights and concerned about what's happening with Muslims in the Muslim world, I'm very aware of that story. It's very, very complicated and difficult, but that's a topic for another night.
So just to final question, to finish where we started, Zev, could you, to finish where we started, you haven't said much about the Liberals, but of course all the, in relation to, and you've covered this in your other book, in relation to the initiative vis-a-vis Soviet Jews, that starts off surprisingly in the Menzies government with Sir Garfield Barwick, I think, as the foreign minister. And that's unexpected. You wouldn't, I mean, you've spoken about Bob Hawke, we can understand that, but how come that the Liberals got interested in this? So, but before pretty well anyone else in the Western world.
Correct. And it's a bit, since Sir Garfield Barwick is no longer with us, and it was really he who stood up, because Tangi, who was head of the, which was then not Foreign Affairs, but External Affairs, the Department of External Affairs, he was certainly not pro, and the UN representative at the stage, White, I think his name was, sent a telegram back saying, we don't want to raise this. If we raise it, the Soviets will bring up the treatment of the Indigenous Australians, and none of the other Western countries are raising it. Why should we? And Sir Garfield Garwick answers, I have promised in the Australian Parliament it will be raised, you have to raise the issue. Why he did it, he certainly was anti-communist. I think it's probably the best explanation at the time. And, you know, he wasn't that close to the Jewish community. But so it's a bit hard to be definitive. But he did have a strand of concern for human rights, and we discussed that. So it's a bit of supposition as to why. But later I'm referred to Malcolm Fraser. I mean, Fraser plays a key role in the period of the Olympic Games when Izzy becomes the official carrier for Australia for the Moscow Olympic Games. And Izzy has, in the end, three trips. You have to read the book to get the details. But Malcolm Fraser's support at that time was crucial. And Izzy was very careful while in Australia, not later on in Israel, where he became an open supporter of Bibi Netanyahu, that he was always bipartisan. And both with Fraser and with Hawke, what's interesting, what drew both men to Izzy and he to them was concern for human rights.
Well, that's a good point on which to end, Susan. So thank you very much. Thanks to everyone joining in tonight and those who've joined in on Zoom. And as I said, we've got copies of Lone Voice. Izzy Liebler was quite an extraordinary Australian and someone who knew him for a long time. I don't think I ever understood him, but I certainly knew him, and he was very impressive. And this is about the wars of Izzy Liebler. My war with Izzy Liebler was very small, and I lost it. But the last time I saw him was at Mark Liebler's office, and we're launching a book, down in Melbourne and also in Israel. We last saw him at the King David Hotel. We had dinner together with Sam Lipsky, Anne and myself. So we all ended up great buddies, and I'm delighted that at the Sydney Institute tonight we're kicking off Lone Voice, The Wars of Busy Labour Season. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.